Chapters of Life by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 6, A World We All Must Visit. The gentle rain came pattering down, lightly washing the soot-laden slates of the old market town. Like the tears of new widows, it fell from gray skies to tinkle across the garbage cans with musical fingers. To the soft sighing of the evening wind, it danced and swayed across the roadways, tapping against windows and bathing the parched foliage of such scrawny trees as still stood with lower trunks immured in concrete sidewalks. The light of passing cars reflected from the glistening roadway, their tires hissing through the thin sheet of water which collected from the poorly drained surface. Tap, tap, tap went the rain drops as they ran gleefully together from the old gray roof and flowed into the broken spout to fall onto the worn stone steps below. Passers-by hurried along, muttering imprecations against the weather, turning up collars and erecting umbrellas. Those caught unprotected hastily improvised shelter from unfolded newspapers. A cautious cat sidled along close-pressed to the houses, jumping puddles and ever alert to find the driest places. Tiring of the wet or possibly reaching home, the cat gave a long, cautious look around, then squeezed through a partly opened window. From around the corner came a slight hurrying figure, clad in dark raincoat and sheltering beneath a small black umbrella. Pausing a moment beneath a street lamp, she consulted a slip of paper clutched between her fingers. Peering in the dim light, she checked again the address and number before hurrying on. Here and there, she halted her hurried flight to bend forward and read the numbers on the house doors. At last, with a small exclamation, she stopped by the corner house. Hesitantly, she looked at it. A small house, a poor house, with paint sun-blistered on the door. The window frames were cracked for want of paint, and the stonework had seen much better days. Yet, she decided, it was a happy house. Hesitating no longer, she mounted the three small stone steps and knocked timidly at the door. Soon there came the sound of footsteps within the house and the slight creak as the door opened. "Mrs. Ryan?" asked the woman on the step. "Yes, I'm Mrs. Ryan. Can I help you?" responded the other. Then, "Won't you come in out of the rain?" Gratefully, the small woman folded her umbrella and stepped inside. As Mrs. Ryan took her wet coat, the slight woman looked about her. She saw an elderly, gaunt woman with a kind face and work-worn hands. A woman who, like her house, had seen better days, but one who had well learned life's hard lessons. The furniture was clean but well worn, and the linoleum was beginning to be shabby. The slight woman turned with a start and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, my mind was wandering. I'm Mrs. Harvey. Mrs. Ellis told me about you. I desperately need help." Mrs. Ryan gazed at her gravely and said, "Come into the sitting room with me, Mrs. Harvey. Let us see what the trouble is." She led the way into a small, neat room facing down the street. Motioning to a chair, she said, "Won't you sit down?" Gratefully, the slight woman sank into the comfortable chair. "It's about Fred," she cried. "He died 5 weeks ago, and I miss him so." Memory overcame her, and she wept with an agony of emotion. Fumbling in her handbag, she withdrew her handkerchief and dabbed ineffectually at her streaming eyes. Mrs. Ryan patted her on the shoulder and said, Now, just sit there and have your cry out. I'll make a cup of tea and then you'll feel better. Hurrying from the room, she entered the kitchen from whence soon came the clatter of teacups. I've had a terrible time, said Mrs. Harvey later, as they sat facing each other with the tea tray between them. Fred, my husband, and I were very much in love, and then, 5 weeks ago, he was killed instantly in an explosion at the works. It was horrible. Every night I've had the strongest feeling that he was trying to get in touch with me, to tell me something. She stopped and twisted her handkerchief nervously, biting her lower lip and scuffling the worn carpet on the floor. Then Mrs. Ellis told me that you might be able to get in touch with Fred. I don't know what you charge, but I do so want to hear from him. My dear, said the elderly woman to the anxious young widow, we can only try and trust in God. Sometimes I can receive messages from those who have left this life. Other times I cannot. Only the highest adepts can always be telepathic and clairvoyant. If I can help you, then that's God's will. If I cannot, then that is God's will too. As for my charge, she waved a hand around the room, I do not look as if I overcharge and live in luxury, do I? She sighed and added, a machine could be constructed whereby this world and the unseen could communicate just as we now telephone another country. But industry is not interested. Tell me about your husband. Have you some personal article of his that I may attempt to contact him? Much, much later, a smiling and greatly comforted Mrs. Harvey stood up to leave and said, I know now that there are mediums and mediums. Some are absolute swindlers, as I've found to my cost. Some raise hopes falsely and without having any ability whatever. You are very different. Thank you so much, Mrs. Ryan. As she softly closed the door after the departing Mrs. Harvey, the gaunt old medium muttered, Lord, Lord, if only we could stop all the fakes and have real research, how easily we could then communicate. She turned back into the sitting room and slowly gathered up the tea things, thinking of a séance which she had once attended. The shops had closed early, for it was the middle of the week, when all the pay packets were empty, and larders, too, were becoming bare in anticipation of the morrow's shopping spree. The shops had closed early, and from the great city had flowed clerks and accountants, typists and shop girls. Great rivers of humanity had stormed the barriers at the tube stations and rushed like a roaring torrent down the escalators, sweeping along the subway to stand at last in a solid mass along the station platforms. From the deep tunnels came the reverberating vroom, vroom of the trains as they approached. At the first glimmer of train light wavering in the darkness, an uneasy surge swept the waiting masses. Strong ones pushed forward, weak ones were roughly shoved aside. As the train slowed into the station to stop with a dying sigh of air brakes, the crowd rolled forward and were engulfed by the carriages. A thud as the rubber-lined doors shut, and the dull throbbing of the air compressors pumping pressure to keep the brakes off, and the train rolled away, gathering speed as the next wave of work-leaving humans poured down the subways to stand sheep-like on the so recently vacated platform. At last, the pushing crowds thinned and dwindled to a trickle. Soon the trains became less frequent, for this was the time of home returning for the workers. Later, the flow would be partly reversed as theater-goers and window shoppers returned for their evening pleasures. Soon, ladies of the night would appear to loiter in darkened doorways or flaunt themselves beneath the lamplights. Soon, policemen would saunter through the shopping areas, leisurely trying premises for unlocked doors, peering into parked cars and being unobtrusively alert for the unusual and illegal. But not yet. The workers had but recently left for home. Far out in the suburbs, people were getting up from their evening meal. Some were dressing for theaters. Others were wondering how to spend an idle evening. Others were going to meetings. Down the road, in twos and threes, came a small group converging on a big old house that stood back somewhat from the road, like an old person trying to keep aloof from the common herd. The bushes hiding the facade were unkempt, untrimmed, reminding one of a man with long uncut hair on his neck. Above the portico, a single unshaded bulb glowed dimly through the mess left by singed flies and insects. Briefly, a face appeared at an upstairs window and peered down the road, assessing the number of people approaching, and then vanishing in the twitching of a quickly drawn curtain. Soon, people were congregating at the portico, calling greetings to friends, eyeing new faces with unfriendly suspicion. Soon the door was opened, and a very large, very stout woman, bedecked with strings of imitation pearls, appeared. Washing her hands with invisible soap and water, she beamed toothily upon the group facing her. "Well, well," she exclaimed archly, "the spirits told me that we should have a record number tonight. Now, if you'll just come in." She moved aside, and people filed into the gloomy hallway. "Leave your love offerings there," said the stout woman, as she pointed to a deep plate standing in an alcove. A banknote, weighted down with 4 half-crowns, already rested in the capacious bottom, giving silent hints as to the amount of love offering expected. Under the watchful eyes of the stout woman, the congregation fumbled in pocket and purse and dropped their offerings into the rapidly filling plate. "That's right," said the woman. "We must not let our spirit friends think their efforts are unappreciated, must we? The more we give, the more we receive," she added smugly. The little group of people moved into a large room with what appeared to be a stage at one end. Hard wooden chairs were placed in irregular ranks, and these were rapidly occupied by the crowd, with nervous newcomers being pushed to the back rows. The stout woman moved ponderously to the stage and took her place in the center, playing with her bracelets impatiently. A tall, thin woman appeared and sat down before a half-concealed harmonium and played the first bars of a hymn. "Just a few hymns first to get the atmosphere right," said the stout woman. "Then we'll get down to business." For some minutes the organ played and the people sang. Then the stout woman waved her hands imperatively and said, "Stop! Stop! The spirits are waiting!" The last notes died away from the organ in a wail of diminuendo as the bellows emptied of air. There was a rustle and creak of furniture as people sat and shuffled to become at ease. The lights dimmed, went out, and were replaced by red ones, which shed an eerie glow over all. Upon the platform, the stout woman peered and pranced. "Oh, boys," she exclaimed coquettishly, "wait, wait, you must speak in turn. There are many waiting to speak tonight," she exclaimed to her audience in an aside, "and they are very impatient. Many of you will have messages tonight," she added. For some time, she writhed on the platform, giggling and rubbing her head. "Now," she exclaimed at last, "they have had their fun, so to business." Looking about her, she suddenly asked, "Mary, the name is Mary. Has anyone here by the name of Mary lost a dear one recently?" Dubiously, a hand rose. "I lost my stepfather 6 months ago," said a nervous young woman. "He was a great sufferer. I'm sure it was a relief when he went." The stout woman nodded and remarked, "Well, he asked me to tell you that he is happy now and is sorry for all the work he caused you." The nervous young woman nodded and whispered to her companion. "Smith," called the stout woman, "I have a message for Smith. I'm asked to say that you are not to worry. Everything will be all right. You understand what I mean, don't you? I can hardly talk about it in the meeting like this, but you understand." Near the front, a young man nodded his head in assent. "The boys are in great form tonight," said the stout woman. "They have so many messages for you. I'm just like a telephone, you know, giving the messages from our dear departed who are yet with us in the spirit. Wait, wait, what is that? Oh, they say that I should ask for special contributions so that I may have this room decorated. They don't like to visit in shabby rooms. Will you help? Will you contribute towards this worthy cause? Miss Jones, will you pass the plate around, please? Thank you." Let it be stated at the outset that it is quite possible, under certain conditions, to receive messages from those who have passed over. At the same time, it must be stated equally definitely that people who have left this world have a job to do, and they just do not sit around in groups waiting like a gang of youths on a street corner to get a word in somehow. Many of the messages are fake messages, either from elementals or from ungenuine mediums. First, we should deal with one or two of the very real dangers of occultism and metaphysics, and everything else that comes within that classification. Of course, there is no danger whatever to the person practicing occultism for a pure reason. I have quite a different thing in mind. One of the biggest dangers which we face is that posed by cranks, crackpots, the mentally deluded, and those who think they are Cleopatra or some such similar reincarnation. The number of Cleopatras would probably populate the whole of New York and leave an overflow for the rest of the United States. It is most unfortunate that the emotionally unstable flock to occultism like flies to a jam pot, and the bigger cranks they are, the more danger they make for us who are trying to do a decent job. Let me make this quite definitely clear. Occultism is a natural thing. There's nothing mysterious about it. It is just the use of powers which almost everyone has, of which almost everyone has forgotten how to use. Put it this way, we have an ordinary average person who shall be our guide stick or our yardstick. This ordinary average person is our indicator. A person with less intellect is below average, so a denizen of a mental home can be very much below average. The subnormals, those who are below average, do not engage our attention. But those who are in possession of abilities which our average indicator does not possess, then they are above normal, paranormal. People with occult abilities are paranormal, and they have abilities which are not developed in the average person. A savage has a very keen sense of smell, and often a very keen sense of eyesight also. He senses far above anything which the so-called civilized person does. A civilized person has the same potentialities for increased smell or sight, but conditions of alleged civilized life make the exercise of smell, power, and sight, keenness, a positive drawback. Think of going to some of those restaurants. If one's smell was phenomenally acute, the stench would knock one over backwards. The person with occult power, then, is not a magician, not anything like that. He's just a person who has developed certain senses possessed by everyone else. In the same way, we all have muscles, but the weightlifter has developed his muscles to a far greater extent than has the little old lady who sits in a chair all day long. And the man who engages in politics, he has developed his vocal cords far beyond that of a man who stays at home all the time. They both have muscles, they both have vocal cords, but the stages of development of those organs are different. One of the most important of the occult laws is that one should not indulge in exhibitionism. One should not drag down occult power by what becomes a mere circus turn. How often does one hear a woman say, "Oh, I met a wonderful man today. He came to my door. He's a Spanish onion seller in the mornings. In the afternoons, he sells ladies' wear, and in the evenings, he gives occult demonstrations. He's so utterly wonderful. He can balance on one finger while drinking a cup of tea upside down." Or how often do we hear of some poor little man, so lonely, so forgotten by the world, that he has to say, "Ah, I've read a book about occultism. I will now set up to be a great teacher and a master." So he goes to work by day, perhaps canvassing from door to door, or perhaps being a meek little man under a domineering employer. And by night, he sets off to his back room, puts on a mysterious look, flaps his eyebrows up and down, sights down the side of his nose, makes weird sighs and groans, and perhaps also does a stage trick or two, says how wonderfully he can do astral traveling. Actually, he has probably had too much supper or bad cheese or something, and he has had a nightmare. Well, that little man is a real pest. He's a real danger to occultism and to himself. I am going to tell you that all these crackpots who put on stage shows and call it occultism are going to have to pay time after time until they learn better. And they're going to have to come back to this earth, and that should be a threat enough to put anyone off. In India, there is a sect of people called the Fakirs. They pose as holy men. They travel about India, and no attractive woman is safe from them. But they put on stage shows. They put on tricks. Well, I, for one, if you want to see a good conjuring show, I would rather pay and go to a good variety theater. I don't want to see a dirty little man squatting on the ground trying to hypnotize a whole group of people. That doesn't prove anything spiritual to me. It proves instead that the person has not even the first conception of spiritualism. The Indian rope trick is just a simple matter of hypnotism. I'm going to tell you, though quite definitely, that the real masters, who never prove anything to satisfy the idle curiosity seekers, can actually do the so-called Indian rope trick by utilizing natural powers, and that does not employ hypnotism. I will tell you quite truthfully that I and many others have seen levitation. Levitation is a very real thing indeed, and it is not at all mysterious. It is a matter of reversing magnetic currents. If you get hold of two magnets, two bar magnets for preference, if you hold them, one in each hand, and bring them together, they may jump together with a loud metallic clang, often pinching a bit of flesh in between. But if you reverse the direction of just one, that is, if you take the one in your right hand and you put the south pole where the north pole was before, and you try to bring these two magnets together, you will find that they make quite strenuous efforts to evade each other. They oppose each other. They have no magnetic attraction to each other. They have repulsion instead. Another thing. One can have a form of induction coil connected to a battery or to the mains, and over a shaft which projects upward, one can drop an aluminum ring. If the current is switched on, the ring apparently defies gravity and floats in the air. If anyone doubts the truth of this, well, they should consult some scientific magazine or write to the United States for a demonstration kit. But let us get back to what we are discussing seriously. Levitation is a method of altering our own magnetic attraction so that we do not weigh so much. In England, about 60 years or so ago, there was a young man called Home. He gave an actual demonstration of levitation in an English country house. Some of the world's foremost scientists witnessed the demonstration, but because the demonstration disproved the laws which those scientists had formulated, they would not give an unbiased report. In Tibet and China before the communists made a commotion there, that is, and Japan before the United States soldiers made a commotion there as well, one saw a lot of levitation and similar things. But these things were never done as a circus turn, but only for the science of raising the kundalini in sincere and genuine students. Let us, then, be true occultists, and let us very, very seriously suspect anyone who offers to give a demonstration of balancing on one finger or any of those really crackpotted asininities, which the person with no confidence in himself and no occult powers at all tries to delude the unwary with. The true occultist never gives proof of his abilities unless there is a completely overriding good reason for it. I should also include in this people like Dinah Dripdry, the backstreet clairvoyant. This poor woman, perhaps for several hours a day, scrubs floors, carrying around a bucket and a mop. Then at the end of her work, she trudges off home and gets herself done up in some really outlandish fashion. She sticks a colorful thing around herself, and then she wraps a sort of gaudy handkerchief around her head, which thing looks like a turban. She has very dim lights in the room so the clients won't see how dirty it really is, and then she's ready to start business. Frequently, she's got a hold of some sort of crystal from somewhere. Often it's kept as a showpiece, exposed to the sunlight, so that people will see this thing and think, what a wonderful woman she is when she's not scrubbing floors. Well, there's nothing that ruins a crystal more thoroughly than being exposed to sunlight. It kills the odinetic power of the crystal. Dinah Drip Dry, then, has somehow lured a foolish client into her room. Usually, she sits down opposite him, looks him up and down, and gets him talking a bit. Most people are so fond of hearing their own voice that they tell all and a bit more. So, Dinah Drip Dry merely has to look in her crystal, seeing nothing but her own reflection, and repeat back in gloomy tones some of the things which your client has told her. Then she gets a reputation for being a great seeress. The client frequently doesn't remember having told her anything, and he parts with his money without a murmur. Dinah Drip Dry cannot be a clairvoyant if she's doing it for money, because that loses her the power, even if she had it in the first place. No average clairvoyant is clairvoyant all the time throughout 24 hours. A person may be highly clairvoyant at a most inconvenient time, but then, when there is need for clairvoyance, the person is not clairvoyant. And if you're doing it for money, you cannot say, "Oh, this is one of my off days. I don't feel able to tell you the truth today." So people like Dinah Drip Dry have to make their money, and when they cannot see anything in the crystal, which is all of the time with them, then they have to make things up. You will have experiences of not being in top form all the time. You may say, "I don't know what's wrong with me. I can't concentrate today." Well, in the same way with clairvoyance, you don't concentrate in clairvoyance. You do just the reverse. So that if a person is tensed up or too excited, then that person cannot relax, and for the time being, the clairvoyant ability falls off. The second rule is, for the sake of your own pocketbook, never, never pay anything, whatever, to have your fortune told by a crystal gazer or a person like that. They cannot do it for money. And if they try to put it on a commercial basis, then they just have to make up from time to time. And the more a person makes up things, the more quickly they lose any clairvoyant ability which they might have possessed in the first place. Another thing which should be made clear now is that no person can control the astral of another. You sometimes get an idiotic sort of woman who does a cackle of laughter, like a hen about to lay a particularly large egg, and says, "Oh, I've got a hold on you. I met you in the astral last night, and now I can control your astral." If you ever meet a person like this, the best thing is to call those white-coated attendants who carry the mentally afflicted off to a comfortably padded cell. No person can suffer any injury when in the astral. No person can be controlled by another person while in the astral. The only thing to be afraid of is of being afraid. Fear is like a corrosive acid on the mechanism of a thing like a watch. Fear corrodes. Fear corrupts. So long as you are not afraid, nothing at all bad can happen to you. So again, if any idiotic crackpot claims to be able to control you, then you'd better send them off to be examined by a psychiatrist or call the police. It's time the police did something anyhow. It's not possible, except under certain conditions and circumstances, to hypnotize a person against the person's will. Of course, those who have been trained in Tibet, and only in the Temple of the Inner Mysteries of Tibet, could do such a thing if they wanted to, for a good reason. But every person who has been trained in the Inner Temple of Mysteries of Tibet has himself been hypnotically conditioned so that he cannot do anything of this type to harm anyone else, but only to help someone else, and even then, only in very unusual circumstances. If someone starts gazing at you and trying to hypnotize you, then gaze straight back at the bridge of his nose between his eyes. Gaze straight back, and if he doesn't know enough, he will soon be hypnotized instead of you. You have nothing to fear, whatever, except of being afraid. Occultism is an ordinary thing, just the same as breathing or lifting a book or taking a step. You can walk safely, unless you're clumsy and careless, and then you can slip on a banana. Well, that's your fault, not the fault of walking. Occultism is safer than walking, because there are no banana skins in occultism. The only thing to be afraid of, I repeat, is of being afraid. Of course, it's quite difficult trying to reason with people, quite difficult trying to explain a thing to a person, because there is a definite law that in any battle between the emotion and reason, emotion always wins, no matter how great one's intellect, no matter how great one's reasoning power. If one gets really excited and enraged, the emotion overrides the reason. A person lives in a tall apartment building, 9 floors high, if you like. These buildings have a flimsy iron railing at the edge of their balconies. A good push would probably knock the thing over, but emotion tells us that it is quite safe because there is a railing there, and we experience no fear at all. But supposing that railing was removed, then we should have great fear of falling, even if we stood in precisely the same position as we should have stood if the railing had been there. At all times, then, we should keep in mind that in any battle between emotion and reason, emotion always wins, and for that reason, we should not let ourselves get unduly excited. Instead, we should try to get a step nearer to nirvana, which is the controlling of emotion, so that no longer does it stop the workings of reason. We must realize that some of these little backstreet people who have read a book or perhaps have just heard of the title of a book are not necessarily the best teachers. The only person who is qualified to teach anything to do with the occult is the person who obviously knows, a person who has been trained at a reputable place. I, for instance, can and have produced papers showing that I have been trained and hold medical degrees of the University of Chungking, and my papers describe me as a Lama of the Potala Monastery of Lhasa. Naturally, one does not produce such papers just for curiosity seekers or to settle bets, as I have frequently been asked. Publishers have seen such papers, and they testify to that in their foreword in one or more of my books. One would not go to a quack doctor, one who would give us a bonk on the head with a mallet in order to make us unconscious and so oblivious to pain. One would only go to a qualified doctor. In the same way, one should not go to a quack who has no real knowledge of the occult except some imaginary sounds in the head. All too often, as you know, voices in the head may even be a symptom of mental derangement. You should choose your occultist as soundly as you choose your physical doctor. When a person leaves this earth, they may be advanced people who have gone on to higher places. In that case, only a medium with a very considerable power can make contact, because in ordinary physical concepts, those who have passed over have gone to a different time zone. And if you try to telephone Australia from England, then unless you know the time zone of your friend, you cannot get in touch. You may be trying to call in the middle of the night, for instance. But in our medium case, we are trying to call someone who is already a few thousand light years into the future. Most times, a medium who lacks experience will be deluded by those plausible beings who are also known as elementals. Perhaps we should discuss elementals so that we may know something about the subject. People have rather remarkable ideas about that order of being which we call elementals. Frequently they're confused with the soul of humans, but they are nothing at all like that. They mimic humans just the same as monkeys copy humans. And the average medium who cannot see into the astral will be led astray by elementals pretending to be humans. Elementals are not evil spirits either. They're merely the thought forms which have been generated by constant repetition. For example, if a person constantly gets drunk, then that person will have confused thoughts and has excess energy, being no longer under control, will run wild and will perhaps conjure up thoughts of pink elephants or spotted lizards or something like that. These things are elementals. As we have said, each cycle of evolution is constituted by those leaving a cycle and those starting a cycle. So we get what is in effect a life wave of living souls or overselves, and each of these waves has its own contribution to evolution. It leaves its own pattern, just the same as an Oxford man leaves a different pattern on civilization to the Yale man, and the Borstal man leaves yet a different pattern. So when this life wave goes on, their memory remains as a static force, and as there have been so many people concerned, the force is built up into what is, in the astral plane, a solid creature. These creatures, which have been built up and left behind by succeeding waveforms or cycles of evolution, are solid creatures, but they lack the divine spark. They lack intelligence, and instead they're only able to mimic or reproduce things which have entered into their consciousness at some time. You can, if you try hard enough, teach a parrot to repeat a few words. It does not necessarily understand the words, but the parrot is repeating a sonic pattern. In the same way, elementals repeat a cybernetic pattern. For those who are really interested in the subject, elementals are divided into many different types, in much the same way as in humans there are black people, brown people, yellow people, white people, etc. In the elemental groups, there are four main types attached to the earth astral plane, and that is how we get some of the qualities of astrology. The astrologer will know of the spirits of air, the spirits of fire, spirits of water, and the spirits of earth, for they are the four main types of elementals. The witchcraft people, or the alchemist, would refer to them as gnomes for one group, sylphs for the second group, salamanders for the third group, and for the last group, undines. If you want to take it a bit farther, beyond the astrologer and beyond the witches, you can go to the stage of the chemists, because you can say that the earth group represents a solid in which all molecules adhere. After the solid, we have the liquid, or water, in which molecules move freely. Next on our list is air, which also includes gases of various types, and in the air the molecules repel each other. Finally, for our chemical correspondence, there is fire, and in fire molecules change or transmute into some other substance. The term elemental is almost always reserved for those beings who occupy a place in one of the groups just mentioned, but there are other groups such as nature spirits. Nature spirits control the growth of trees and plants, and they help in the transmutation of organic compounds so that plants may be enriched and fertilized. These groups all have an over-self head, or if you prefer, an oversoul. They are known as the Manu. The human tribe has a Manu. Each country has a Manu, and nature spirits have a Manu. There is a Manu who controls and oversees the work of the tree spirits, just as there is a Manu who controls the work of the rock spirits. In Egypt, many, many centuries ago, highly trained priests were able to get in contact with these Manus. For example, Bubastis, the cat god, the Manu of cats everywhere. We must have negative, or we cannot have positive. So, just as there are good spirits, there are also evil spirits, demons, if you like. They are evil to us here, but on another plane of existence, they may be good. If you are at all electrically inclined, this explanation might appeal to you. Suppose you have a 12-volt car battery. At the extreme is the positive, and at the other extreme is the negative. But now, supposing that you connect another battery, 6 or 12 volt, in series on to the first battery, then the negative of the original battery will be as the positive of the second battery, and the negative of the second battery will be more negative than the negative of the first battery. All this, stated simply, is that everything is relative and to be compared with each other. Thus, we have evil here at present, but if we can find a worse world, then our evil would be as good on that world, and what is good on this world would not be very good at all on the higher world. I said that man was having different waves of evolution. Well, that really is so. For example, there was the Lemurian race, which mainly operated by instincts and passions, and then evolved higher emotions. After that, there came the Atlantean race, which started off with higher emotions and then evolved a reasoning mind. The Aryan race came next. This started off with the functioning mind and will eventually obtain an abstract mind. After the Aryan, we come to the sixth race, which starts with the abstract mind and eventually will obtain spiritual perception. With the seventh race, which will start with spiritual perception, it will go on to achieve cosmic consciousness. For those of you who are interested in the theory of land drift, that is, that the whole world was covered with one continent at the start, and that it broke up under centrifugal rotation, there is now very considerable proof that this, which was known as Pangaea, first separated into two supercontinents known as Laurasia, which was in the north, and Gondwanaland in the south. These, in time, broke up into separate lands and continents. However, that is taking us rather far from our original theme. A medium is a person who, through some difference in brain structure, is able to receive messages from another plane of existence, in just the same way as a radio can receive messages which the unaided human ear cannot. A medium usually goes into a form of trance, either light or heavy, depending upon the medium, and during that trance, the consciousness of the medium is suppressed so that another entity can operate the controls and give utterance to certain thoughts in the form of words. Most mediums will have a spirit control from among those who have been kept upon the lower astral for some specific purpose. The spirit control, or guide, as many call it, acts as a policeman and prevents, in some cases, mischievous elementals from doing harm to the medium. The overself of the medium has departed so as to give the guide free rein. But the medium who is sitting in a chair or lying on a couch will not be aware of anything at all. If you see that the medium is looking about, taking too much interest in events, then you can be quite reasonably sure that you do not have a genuine medium. The whole point is that the medium should place his or her personality completely aside and function merely as a telephone. After all, if you're going to get a message from the other side of death, you do not want the medium's interpretation. You want a clear, unbiased statement. And the only way that one can obtain that clear, unbiased statement is to let the spirit communicator communicate without interference from the medium. Again, you should remember that when one gets in contact with what we might term the spirits of the departed, so that they may tell us of their experiences, we merely listen to the accounts of their dreams in the other world, because the really evolved souls have gone on to dimensions which the average medium cannot possibly reach. It is only when one has a real master that one can reach forward into time and call back a message from one of those very far departed souls. And that is why it's so difficult to obtain really worthwhile statements from those who have passed over. Supposing we try to look into the matter of the average medium. Let us say that the woman has some gifts in mediumistic work and she can obtain rapport with people who have passed over. But let us remember that these people who have just passed over are still in the lower astral. They are in what we might term purgatory. They are in the intermediate stage. They are in the waiting room, waiting for directions as to what to do and where to go. Suppose you look upon these people as patients in a hospital, because it is a fact that many of these people do have to undergo certain spirit therapy to overcome the shocks of their earth experience. So let us say that we are in contact with one of these people who is as a patient in a hospital. The patient is in bed and thus his only knowledgeable His only knowledge of his surroundings is that limited to the small area visible from his bed. He cannot see the whole work of the hospital, and if he can see other scenery, then possibly it is only that which he can see from a window. Supposing you get a report from one of these guides, or some other spirit whose special task is to assist those who are about to pass over, or who have actually passed over. If they speak, that is much the same as getting a report from some inexperienced little nurse or ward maid at the hospital. And not even if you can go to a lecture of the hospital committee can you realize the full scope of what is going on. You can only make an evaluation by leaving the hospital and touring, as one might say, the town. When one leaves this world, which we call Earth, one goes to the lower astral, which the Bible terms purgatory. And that may, as we have stated, be regarded as a hospital for sick souls, where they are cured of many of the shocks which they endured or sustained upon this crude, crude earth. Unfortunately, the lower astral would better be compared to a mental home in which patients are received and their cases considered, just as a psychiatrist may sometimes discuss things with a patient so that he himself can state his faults and ailments. So in the lower astral can the newly arrived soul see what he did wrong on the earth and see what he has to do about it to atone. Then for a short time the soul rests and recuperates, and perhaps walks in pleasant parkland, all the time receiving medication and treatment to assist him or her to carry on with the next phase of existence. You will quite appreciate that people in the astral world are absolutely solid to each other. You upon this world can bump into a wall, but a ghost would walk through that wall. Yet in the astral and other planes, the walls are quite solid to those occupants. From all of this, you can see that if you make a commotion and go from medium to medium and seance to seance, trying to get in touch with one who has passed over, then you are causing considerable harm to that person. Think of it this way. A loved one has been taken ill and has been taken to a mental home or some other form of hospital. Suppose you keep on calling and pestering that person, then you impede that person's progress. The doctors cannot get his full attention because you are meddling in his affairs. You are stopping treatment and causing considerable distress. When you try to get in touch with an entity who has gone beyond the lower astral, then you are interfering with a person who is trying to do a particular task. People who have left this world do not just sit about on clouds strumming harps and singing hymns. They have more work to do than they had upon this earth. And if they are subject to continual distraction, then they cannot get on with their work. Suppose you call a very busy executive, or a research scientist, or a surgeon who is doing a difficult operation. Suppose you keep jerking at his coattails, then you distract him, and he cannot give attention to what he is doing. Mediums should never, never try to get in touch with the departed, unless under very special conditions and with very special safeguards. Fortunately, there is already a built-in safeguard. Many worthy mediums, believing absolutely in their own sincerity, merely contact elementals who are having quite a bit of fun. That's all right if you know you are contacting elementals. But if you know that much, why play with a gang of half-witted monkeys? Note from Blue Friend. Dr. Rampa mentions a man famous for levitation. That man's name was Daniel Douglas Home. End of chapter 6.